Hello, welcome to another episode of History Hack. Today's World War II Day. So I, of course, am incredibly excited. I'm also really excited because I've got a friend of mine on board and we're going to be talking about something that we don't really talk much about during the Second World War. And I'm so eager to learn more. We've got with us Mark Conaghan, who is a historian and archaeologist. He's currently working on a subject, like I said, we just don't talk about during the Second World War. And ladies and gentlemen, he is going to absolutely blow your mind. We're going to be talking about the Blitz. I can just hear you saying, yeah, I know, we know about the Blitz, we talk about the Blitz, but we don't talk about this part of the Blitz, let alone I don't know much about this part of the Blitz. And we're talking about the Blitz in Scotland. More specifically, we're going to be talking about Glasgow. Welcome, Mark, to our podcast.
Thank you for having me on, Alina.
I'm really, really looking forward to this one because we were hashing out what you should talk about, because you do archaeology as well, don't you? You're not just a historian talking about the Blitz.
No, I started with doing my master's degree in conflict archaeology and then moved on to doing my PhD in conflict archaeology. So technically, my focus is archaeology, but it's a lot more history when it comes to talking about Clydeside and the Blitz.
Do you know, I had a dream the other night. I don't know if you saw on Twitter, I had a dream that I went on an excavation. Because originally I was supposed to be a classical archaeologist. That was my main focus, and then I obviously became a very modern historian. And I think something's trying to tell me either, Elena, go become an archaeologist again, or Elena, get the holes digging out of the way, or Elena, you're just dreaming. What do you think?
Well, whatever you want to do. I mean, I started off digging some holes and things like that and found out I like to talk more about history and talk about archaeology than I actually do, getting down on my knees and hurting my poor old knees, trying to dig holes and do all that stuff. So I've
It's
been told that
age.
my trail work is absolutely awful. So, I mean, obviously I should stick to writing and talking about it then.
It's age really for you, isn't it? It is
It must
age.
be because I'm quite old.
Oh, such an ancient gentleman you are.
Yes, I'm a lofty 48 years old.
Oh, all over the hill. Oh, do not quote me on that, ladies and gentlemen. I do not think people in their 40s are old because I'm not far behind Mark. But look, let's do some blitz chatting. You're really good at this because when we were prepping, we spent a lot of time. And for me to try and summarize and put questions out of this was really difficult.
What that means is I can't actually keep things precise and I talk too much, Alina. I think that's what you're politely saying there.
Let me put it this way, for this subject, it is not a bad thing because you've got so much to tell us and so much to say. So we'll start off with the first question. So like I've mentioned previously, we all know what the Blitz was, but it wasn't just confined to England. Scotland was also targeted. So let's have an overview of this. Where was Scotland actually bombed?
Well, the first places that were actually attacked in Britain were in Scotland, which a lot of people don't actually know. Right in the beginning of the war, especially in October, the Germans attacked the naval base at Rosyth, just at the, if you know where the kind of the fancy red rail bridge is in the Forth Estuary, it's just to the side of that. And the Germans had actually sent reconnaissance planes over and thought they had spotted HMS Hood. So they then sent off over some Junkers to attack it. But strangely enough, as it may seem later in the war, the boat that was there was actually the Repulse, the HMS Repulse, and it was actually docked at Rosyth. And according to what historians have now found out, that the Luftwaffe pilots were told not to attack the boats in the dock lest they end up having civilian casualties because they were very, very not wanting to actually kill civilians, even though they were trying to attack the shipping. Luckily or unluckily, if you like, that there were also two ships to on the other side of the rail bridge. That was the HMS Edinburgh and HMS Southampton that were berthed there. So the Junker planes decided to attack them instead. And that was actually the first attack, in Scotland at the naval base there. And that was October 16, 1939. The following day, the Luftwaffe attacked Scapa Flow in the Orkneys, which was also a naval base. And all throughout that early period of the war, the attacks from, if you can imagine, round about the Aberdeen to Peterhead area of Fraserburgh, they actually called that Hellfire Corner. There were so many attacks on not only shipping Royal Navy assets, but also just on the towns. So, for example, small towns in the northeast of Scotland, I'll give an example. Peterhead was attacked 28 times by the Luftwaffe, Aberdeen 24 times, and Fraserburgh 23 times. And all around that area was constantly being attacked by the Luftwaffe, who's seen it as a kind of area where the Royal Navy was moving ships up that east coast, specifically up to Scapa Flow. And this actually became worse as the war progressed, because if you have, once the Germans invade Denmark and Norway, Scapa Flow becomes the closest area where they're actually transporting troops across or doing a lot of, you know, a lot of naval activity up there. So they all become a target for the Germans. And of course, Scapa Flow is a famous Royal Navy base, you know, that was attacked frequently throughout the war.
So you hear all of this about, you know, London and Coventry and all these big cities being attacked and bombed. But I'm going to be honest with you, hearing that there are little places like that, like 24, 28 times, you said?
Yeah, Peterhead 28, Aberdeen 24, Fraserburgh 23. You know,
Jesus, it's incredible, isn't it? When you think about it in the whole context.
Yeah, and the first German plane downed in British soil was actually just outside Edinburgh. You know, they call it the Humbie Heinkel. You know, it was actually on an attack again on the 4th yesterday and was shot down by Spitfires. And that was on, I think it was the end of October.
Do we know if the pilot survived?
Do you know, there was survivors, but I don't know if the pilot survived.
Okay, that's interesting. Yeah. Right, okay. So we know what's happening in Scotland right now, as in contextually.
Yeah, and even you know, the first civilian casualty, the first British civilian casualty was also in Scotland. You know, it was a guy called... Yeah,
really?
It was a guy called James Isbister who was killed in the Orkney Islands. I believe it was in March 1940. And again, it's funny enough, it's one of these controversial things, because it was then changed to be someone on the south coast because they were the first person to die on the British mainland rather than the small island that happens to be just off the British mainland, which is, of course, part of Britain. But he was actually the first person that was killed, you know, and a lot of this wasn't well known at the time, you know, because most of the fighting that was actually happening, a lot of it was happening off the northeast coast of Scotland.
So, silly question just to throw in this. Is this an official where they say that it was from the mainland and they kind of dismiss the Scottish Isles?
Yeah.
Or, okay.
Yeah, it's, you know, I mean, I don't know if it, I don't believe it came down from the government. It was probably just the media. You know, they're always the first plane, the first this, the first that. And of course, the first British civilian casualty, you know, was this man. But technically, that was on the British mainland. Actually, it was a family that was killed by a parachute mine. I think it was Clapham on Sea, if I remember right. But the James Isbister was actually the first civilian killed by, you know, German attacks in World War II. But he's almost kind of airbrushed out of history, you know, for the one that happened on the mainland.
So let's move on to what our main focus really is. Now, that is Glasgow. That's where you are right now.
Yes.
In Glasgow.
Yeah.
Glasgow's, well, it is a major Scottish city, and it still is a major Scottish city. So it must have clearly also been targeted. So why is this city specifically so important?
Well, Glasgow was is an important Scottish city, but we have to think back to the context of Glasgow during World War II. You know, prior to World War II, Glasgow was often referred to as the second city of the British Empire. And, you know, its involvement in major shipping industry, steelworks, ammunition, all was actually pre-war. You know, obviously it was also a main route, you know, for ships that were involved in the Atlantic convoy going out the North Channel over to the Atlantic. So there's always been, you know, Glasgow always played a very important part. When it comes up to the start of World War II, you know, the belief is that the Germans don't have the capability to attack Glasgow because it's out with the range, which in the most part it was in the very early parts of the war. So a lot of industry then moves up to Glasgow as well. Glasgow already had a substantial area. When I say Glasgow, I should say Clydeside, because it takes in a larger area just in Glasgow city as well. But in Clydeside, there was already a massive shipyard industry, steelworks, munitions, all that. And then as the wars begin to start, they actually increase it and actually send more stuff up there because they believe it's out with the range. What happens very quickly is that as the Germans move in to Denmark and Norway, it opens up for planes to be attacking Glasgow. Mostly nuisance raids, you know, just a couple of planes at a time. It actually increases as the first years of the war go on. There is more attacks with more planes. But it's only after the fall of France that Glasgow can then be a more major target. Part of the reason why Glasgow wasn't attacked so much is that they didn't have the beam method that the Germans used to actually attack major cities in Coventry and all that stuff didn't actually reach as far as Glasgow in terms to be precision to attack certain targets. But what it did do was it was good for actually finding directions towards Glasgow. So as we move into that springtime of 1941, the Germans have changed their tactics, and instead of, you know, bombing the cities more like Coventry and the airfields and stuff, they're going for more ports because the British are infiltrated their system of beam directions. And what they're doing is basically saying, well, you know, we're going to bomb more geographically and moonlight nights and things so we can actually find the targets easier. So there's a shift in the Luftwaffe targets in March 1941 to mostly go for coastal cities. Now, cities like Liverpool were always getting bombed, but there's an increase after this. And of course, this is the first time then that Glasgow becomes a target. But to give you an idea, in Glasgow alone, there was 46 primary Luftwaffe targets. And Glasgow's not a big city. I mean, it had a large population, but it doesn't take up a lot of real estate compared to some of the bigger cities that you may have, like London and things like that. But 46 primary targets is a massive amount of targets in one city. And that's just primary targets. You know, you've got everything there from the Royal Navy refueling depot at Dalnotter, which is massive for the Atlantic convoy system, all the way down to the shipyards, ammunitions, explosive factories, Rolls-Royce Hillitine, which is making Spitfire engines at this point, torpedo factories, you name it, Glasgow's got the lot. But up until March 1941, there wasn't any large-scale bombing that would come along in March 13th.
So the bottom line is the people in Glasgow thought that they were safe.
Yeah, and not just the people, some of the politicians as well. You know, there's numerous quotes, and it's quite unfortunate because it happened in early March 1941, where the provost, which is like the mayor of Glasgow, was actually saying things like, you know, Glaswegian tenements, your tenements are a lot stronger than these London ones. They are not going to crumble like some of these London ones were.
Oh, God.
There were other people out there saying that because Glasgow is in kind of the Clyde Valley with hills on either side, that impeded the Luftwaffe's attempts to actually bomb the city, which obviously was not the case. And there were other people, funny enough, there were people who were actually saying to themselves that from crazy rumours that Hitler's nephew lived in Shawlands, which is somewhere in the south side of Glasgow, to just crazy belief that, you know, the Luftwaffe couldn't actually reach them the way they were, you know, because of the such geographical and everything else. So it becomes this strange thing, like, why are we such a target-rich city with massive industry and shipyards that the Germans know all about us? Why are they not actually attacking us? Well, obviously, the mindset was, well, it's because they can, you know, which was obviously very, very wrong.
Well, we're about to delve into this. We're about to delve into what happened in March 1941. But before we start talking through exactly what happened on that fateful night of the 13th, talk to us about your research and about the Clydebank Blitz, because there is a bit of a problem.
Oh, you did it. You did it. Well,
sorry.
That's okay. There's a few problems.
Clear it up for us. Clear it up for us, because right. I've said the wrong word, haven't I? Go
you
on.
Said the bad word. Yes, you said the bad word, Alina. Right. In this, if you do a Google search and you look up Glasgow in World War II, Glasgow Blitz, it will take you automatically to something that describes the Clydebank Blitz. Now, the Clydebank Blitz was the Clydeside Blitz, which was the attack in Glasgow in March 13, 14, 15, 1941. Because Clydebank is a small town in the western side of Glasgow. Now, in 1941, people referred to it as the Clydeside Blitz. All throughout, you know, probably right up until the 70s, 80s, people referred to it as the Clydeside Blitz because they acknowledged the fact that the whole of the Clydeside was attacked. And Clydebank, being a small town on the west side of Glasgow, really did got blitzed to the point where it was almost destroyed. I think out of 12,000 houses, there were 7 that were undamaged due to bomb damage. You know, a population, you know, that was so bombed that most of the people left and didn't actually come back. Clydebank had a far higher population in 1941 than it has ever even reached today. So people were blitzed out, decimated, and there was a massive death toll with Clydebank in terms of population. You know, a large percentage of Clydebank was actually killed. However, the bombings were right along Clydeside. There were more people died in Glasgow than actually died in Clydebank. There were people who died in the south side of the Clyde in Renfrew. There were people who died in Dumbartonshire. But the narrative from probably from the 80s, 90s, moving into the 2000s, has become a Clydebank-centric. So that if you look, even the IWM, if you look up the website, they will tell you that about the Clydebank blitz and almost seem to miss the fact that Glasgow got bombed in the exact same nights and more people died in Glasgow. And the same thing is carried through that from 2000 onwards, most of the books that are written are very Clydebank-centric, even to the point where they actually argue that Glasgow was bombed as a mistake because the Germans were determined to bomb Clydebank.
What?
And the problem is, they've even went on very lengthy books talking about creepback, you know, the theory in World War II of mostly used to describe the British bombing, where you would get over the target and you would start to bomb, and because you bombed and set fires, the next planes coming behind you would drop the bombs on your fires and it would eventually creep back away from the target. Of course, the British resolved that by having cameras where you had to actually fly steady and take photographs of where you bombed, you know, or it wouldn't be awarded to your mission list. The Germans never did that, but the Germans also were actually pretty good at bombing the targets, especially at that time in the war. And what has happened is they have basically argued that everything that landed in Clydebank was the target and everything that landed outside of Clydebank was a mistake, even though that obviously was not the case. But what you have now is that because what happened in Glasgow has virtually been forgotten over the years, even the authorities in Glasgow have no commemorations, memorializations. They don't even talk about it. In fact, they often refer you to, oh, nothing happened here. Everything happened in Clydebank, you know, which means the people who actually died in Glasgow, they're virtually forgotten. Now, to give you an example, in the first 3 hours of the attack on March 13, from 9:15 to 12:15 in the morning, there were 25 parachute mines dropped in Glasgow, 95 high explosive bombs, 864 incendiary bombs, and 533 people killed in those 3 hours. More people died in 3 hours in Glasgow than died in 2 days in Clydebank. You know, so that gives you an idea of how this has almost been wiped out from history and it's not important.
That's incredible. I mean, those kind of statistics. I mean, we're going to come back to these statistics again in just a moment. But this is something that we need to address. I mean, all of us, we do a job for a reason. You know, we're there to flex. So, for example, for me is to stop forgetting all the victims of the concentration camps, you know, to commemorate. This is something very important to you. And I really hope that this will change people's opinions and that you can move forward and, you know, even get the Imperial War Museum to get themselves sort their shit out.
Yeah. Well, every year when it comes around to the anniversary, you know, the March anniversaries of these attacks, in every school, it doesn't matter where you are, it doesn't matter if you're in the north of Scotland, people will be talking about the Clydebank Blitz. All the newspapers will be writing stories about the Clydebank Blitz. Even my own daughters who were going to Glasgow school systems were getting taught about the Clydebank Blitz. And, you know, strange enough, my granny, you know, came from Maryhill in Glasgow and the school she attended was bombed and there were 85 people killed on the second day of the attack. And when I was speaking to people from that school, the kids in that school who actually, the school that they're in has been rebuilt, but that school was bombed. The houses round about it in Kilmun Street were totally devastated and destroyed and all these people died in that attack. And these kids don't even know about where the bombs dropped in the school that they were in or the street that their school was in. But they know about what happened in Clydebank. And that was part of what drove me to actually say, hold on, you know, people need to be aware of the history of where they are and where they live. Instead of, I mean, focus on Clydebank, talk about Clydebank, talk about the whole Blitz. You know, my goal here is not to actually dismiss what happened to Clydebank and promote what happened to Glasgow. It's to say that in the context of the whole attack, this is what happened. Because when you read about this and you think about it in the context of the whole attack, it actually elevates this attack to be a major, if not the major, most damaging attack during the Blitz, including London, for the death toll that happened in Glasgow and Clydebank, if you combine them.
Right, so let's talk about that night. It's the night of the 13th of March, 1941. Talk us through what happened.
Okay. Well, you basically, the as I said earlier, there was a shift in policy, a shift in tactics from the Luftwaffe. And instead of, you know, using the beam method technology to pinpoint targets and to fly en masse and destroy, you know, the likes of Coventry and Bristol, Liverpool, and all the cities that we know of that were attacked, they decided more to go along the lines of finding ports. And part of the reason for that was is they didn't trust the beam technology anymore. They believed, and rightly so, that the Britain was actually interfering with it and causing them problems. So what they decided to do was is they started to attack Hull more frequently, the south coast of England ports. Liverpool get really hammered, you know, in that couple of months period in March, April, May. But they also decided that they were going to have a major attack on Clydeside for the first time. So what they did was is they assembled planes coming from, there were three main, what they call Luftflotten groups. In Norway, there was Luftflotten 5. East of the Seine River, you know, which included planes from the Netherlands, Northwest Germany and France, there was Luftflotten 2. Luftflotten 3 was west of the Seine, up to Brittany. And what they did on this, they staged a three-pronged attack where you would have planes flying from Norway and Denmark, flying over the kind of east, over the North Sea and east coast of Scotland. You would have planes flying from the Western Germany, the Netherlands and part of France, flying up over between Tyne and Tees, you know, south of Newcastle, north of Middlesbrough, flying in that direction. And from the west, the majority of the planes that were on this attack were flying from the west coast of France, flying up the west coast over Cornwall, Wales. Some of them actually split off and bombed Liverpool, which they had actually bombed the night before. Some people have said it was a kind of decoy, but it wasn't. That was always part of the planning to re-bomb Liverpool that second night. But the majority of the planes coming up the west coast flew directly up to Glasgow. There has been a lot of speculation in a lot of the books about who was there first. You know, a lot of my research has shown that probably the first groups that were there first were the ones coming from Norway and Denmark. You know, they were coming across there. They bombed first. The records from the ones coming from Germany and sort of Netherlands and France, they sadly were lost, you know, during the war. But we have decent records for the ones coming from west of the Seine out to Britain. They come up that west coast and how they bombed. But what you have is three different distinct groups that are attacking over a 9-hour period at different heights, at different targets, you know, flying up towards the Clyde. Now, what you have is you have, within this group, you have three Pathfinder groups. Normally, you would have one, you know, which is a group called KGR 100, which was quite well known. They were involved in most of the important raids that we know about, like in Coventry. They were the ones who did most of the damage in mapping out the targets. But the Germans had also switched to a different strategy at this point. And in Glasgow, they actually used three Pathfinder groups, but not traditionally as we would think using them. They would come in at different times. They weren't even the first bombers that arrived on the scene. But what they would do was basically target specific targets along the Clydeside. And that would mean the bombers coming in after them would bomb on between them and on the fires and just continue that trend of bombing within this area. What happens very quickly, though, is that Glasgow, for example, didn't really have much of an anti-aircraft defence. It had anti-aircraft guns, but they weren't very good at shooting down German bombers at night. It certainly is not, because they ran out of ammunition by 10:30. So within an hour and 15 minutes, the Germans were actually noting that nobody was shooting at them anymore. So therefore, you could actually go lower and find targets better. There were Spitfire groups there, you know, to defend Glasgow, but they were ordered not to attack the German bombers, to stay above 20,000 feet, which is very unfortunate when the German bombers are mostly attacking between 3,000 and 9,000 metres. So therefore, they were not even near them and they weren't going below it. One guy disobeyed orders and went down and tried to shoot some German planes, but was unsuccessful. But that is kind of, you know, how the attack started. But in that first couple of hours, they were so successful in what they were trying to target and bomb in the area that the place very quickly became a mess of fire and smoke. So later bombers coming in at 11:30, they actually couldn't actually pick out targets. So what they actually did at that point was switch to secondary targets, and they started attacking roads, railways in particular, And that's what actually led to a lot of the casualties and the deaths, because they were dropping loft mines or parachute mines. And these things were floating down, you know, trying to hit a railway line. And it was actually drifting across and landing on tenements which happened to be adjacent to it. And that probably made up a massive amount of the casualties in Glasgow, because these things were actually quite devastating, especially when they fall between tenement blocks, because they don't explode in impact. They have a lateral explosion, which means that the buildings would just pancake on top of each other or on top of the air raid shelters, where, of course, most people were hiding from the bombing.
I think these are the bombs that kind of shock me the most, because they're smart, very smart what they did, but nevertheless, they're landing on homes, on people's houses, and taking out so many air raid shelters and causing so much damage and so much death in the space of, what, hours?
Yeah. You know, in the space of 3 hours, you know, the majority of the people who will die in this attack are dead. And it's mostly because they were either killed in the explosion, but most of the time were killed by falling masonry, you know, concrete houses falling on top of the air raid shelters, which were not very good to begin with, and certainly wouldn't protect you from a house tenement falling on top of you in the back. But the first bomb that actually landed in Clydeside on these nights was actually a parachute mine that landed in Bankhead Primary School in Drumchapel, which is an area of Glasgow. And it actually, unfortunately, also was like an ARP station. So it was full of firemen, ARP, nurses, you know, first aid people. And there were about 100 people in the school area. 46 actually were killed outright when this bomb landed on top of the school.
Jeez.
You know, thankfully, being in nighttime, of course, there was no kids in the school. But it was, you know, mostly people who were there to actually help during an air raid. You know, so the people who are the ARP, the wardens who are out there helping people, the fire engines who are putting out fires, the nurses and people like that who are giving first aid to people, that was wiped out right away. So, and what happens when the Germans attack Glasgow is there was a massive breakdown in communication, because we live in an age where we can contact people quite easily, but in those days it was telephones is the only thing you had. And they put a little bit of thought into it. They said that in the event of the telephone system going down, we will use schoolboy messengers, basically young 14-year-old boys who would ride about bikes and take messages from A to B when needed. And of course, you plan these things, but you know, when it actually happens and your city's been bombed and there's fires and explosions everywhere, you're then expecting 14-year-old boys to be out there actually taking messages back and forth. And there was actually a number, there was four of them actually killed doing that job, you know, trying to actually help other people by cycling messages back and forth, warning about fires and stuff. The problem is when you're coming in to bomb a city, the Allies became very good at this. The Germans were good at it at the beginning. They had a methodology for how they would attack a city. So if you can imagine the air raid siren going off and you start to drop small, high explosive lots off them, 50 kilogram bombs, not the biggest of bombs, but you can drop multiples of them. And then you start to drop incendiary bombs, you know, which are dropping in the hundreds. So you're basically having small explosions where the firemen and everybody else would be getting into bomb shelters and you're setting fires. Then when these people are coming back out again to actually try and put out the fires, you've got an X wave coming in that's dropping higher, heavy explosive, 250 kilograms, 500 kilogram bombs. So obviously this is actually killing the workers who are actually going out there to try and put out fires. Bombing waves coming in are dropping parachute mines and incendiary bombs. So the parachute mines open up, it's a horrible way to explain it, but they open up the houses, they make it able so that the incendiary bombs can then land and set fire to furniture and inside the houses. Because as the Allies found out in German cities, dropping heavy bombs, you know, does damage, but fires do a lot more damage. And the Germans were very well aware of this as well. And that is what actually happens, is the intention is to open up the houses, get them all set in fire, and that destroys all the structures below. But meanwhile, when people are trying to put out these fires, you're also dropping bombs on top of them in the hope that you'll chase them back underground again and let the incendiary bombs, which they dropped, I mean, there were almost 60,000 incendiary bombs dropped in Clydeside in these two nights. So the intention was is to burn as much as they possibly could. You know, and that was is what happened, is that fire spread everywhere. And when you're dropping a lot of these heavy bombs, you're also breaking up water lines, for example, communication lines. So very quickly, in Clyde Bank, for example, they can't even follow what the government advice is for recording these bomb drops and all these incidents happening, because the whole infrastructure breaks down. They have one working telephone, so they have no water supply, because one of the bombs lands in Kilbowie Road and breaks a major water supply, and it means that none of the fire engine pumps will work. So there's also the problem of logistics when they actually get fire engines to come from Glasgow and other cities to come and help them. The firemen don't know where to put their pipes in because they don't know where the water hydrants were, because they weren't painted different colours in those days so they would stand out. And people don't know where they are. And there's no way of communicating to them how they can assist in actually putting out fires. So you can see how very quickly that all of this great planning before the war totally just went, you know, as soon as the first bombs started dropping. Yes, and that's the one thing, you know, after the war, we all hear about that stiff upper lip and how everybody pulled together and everybody else, when in reality, there was a lot of brave people did a lot of brave things, but the whole communication, the whole ability to actually fight and do stuff just went to pot, especially in March in Scotland.
So you just mentioned, obviously, this was not the only night of bombing, so there was a second night, which is the 14th. The death count wasn't as high this time, however, on the 14th, no, as it was on the 13th. And they also ended up sending a recon plane in the morning of the 14th to check the damage. What was the overall damage at this stage before we even hit the second night?
Well, there was major damage to the Royal Navy oil factory at Dalnotter, which actually, you know, was refueling the ships. There was major damage to that. I think there was about 8 tanks that were on fire, some of them that would burn for a few days, some of them that were putting flumes of smoke and fire, you know, hundreds of feet into the air. So very easy for the Germans to find their way back. But what happened in the first night was is that when the planes were coming in, the very early on, they managed to hit a couple of distilleries, and they hit Singer's Timber Yard, the famous sewing machine factory that was actually containing lots of wood for the war effort as well, and also Dalnotter. And it made a straight line of fires, which made it very easy for German bombers to come in to say, okay, this line of fire is where it's marked, and that's where we're going to drop our bombs. And incidentally, that is part of the reason why Clydebank was damaged so much. There is, a lot of these books have tried to portray the idea that the Germans were singly targeting Clydebank. That is not actually true. Clydebank was destroyed almost by accident, you know, because there was 5 primary targets in Clydebank that the Germans know about, compared to 41 targets in the rest of Glasgow. So what happened was, is because the guys that did the Luftwaffe had did their job very well in marking this straight line, a lot of German planes that came in afterwards just dropped the bombs and run, because they knew that in this area there was, you know, targets, and they assumed that that was marked for them to bomb. And again, this is why it caused so much damage in Clydebank in the first night. On the second night, what happens is most of the people just go away. You know, the people, they're expecting a second night of bombing, because that is normally what the Germans do. At least it's 1-2, you know, because you've marked a lot of the targets, there's going to be fires, and then you go back and bomb them in the second night. It makes it easier to actually find the target when there's still all these fires burning. And what happens is the people on Clydebank just basically flee Clydebank. They get out however they can. The corporation of the area of Clydebank and Glasgow put on buses to move people to Dumbartonshire, Stirlingshire, Renfrewshire, anywhere that is not got a lot of targets, not got a lot of people, just to get these people out of the way. And that is what's happening in Clydebank. So in the second night when they come along, the Germans are actually purposely realising the reconnaissance plane comes over and says, okay, we hit here, 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 but we missed Hillington Rolls-Royce in the south side. We missed the explosive factory. We need to go back and actually target these targets. They want to do more damage to Dalnotter, the Royal Ordnance Factory, and all these other shipyards, which is the field that they didn't do as good a job in the light of day when they look the next day with the reconnaissance plane. So when they come over the next day, they're actually targeting, you know, Dalnotter more, they're targeting Rolls-Royce and Hillington. And what happens is that although these bombs are dropped here, these places are more kind of to the extremities of the city, so there's not actually more bombs dropping in the middle of the Clydebank or more drums dropping in Glasgow as there were in the previous night. There was actually some parachute mines. There was actually as many parachute mines dropped in the second day as there was in the first day, but there was not as much a death toll because, again, people fled knowing what was coming. And as soon as people found out that it was happening again, of course, people were underground and staying out of the way. You know, one of the one I spoke to you about earlier about Kilmun Street where my granny went to school, that was on the second night. You know, and that's just a case of which often happened quite often that these parachute mines were dropped two at a time and they would blow in the wind, of course, off target. They were aiming for, at that time, they were aiming for a chemical works and it blew across the road in a major kind of suburb of Glasgow and exploded, you know, one on the school roof and one in the field behind it. You know, so there was less death toll because people were more bunkered down and obviously had left the city as well, terrified because of what happened the first night.
I mean, this is absolute devastation over 2 days, over the 13th and 14th of March. I mean, clearly this must have been recorded in the newspapers and it must have gone through Britain like absolute wildfire. So how was this attack perceived by the British media? And what was the aftermath like?
Well, that's another one of these troubling things about the attacks on Clydeside. Initially, the media, of course, bear in mind we're at wartime and censorship is high, so they very rarely named when places were actually getting attacked. But what happened was, is very quickly, within a day, they spoke about a minor attack on Clydeside. Now, obviously, people living in Clydeside, watching what's going on in front of them, Clyde Bank is damaged. But it looks like one of these World War II, you know, German cities at the end of the war, when you always see is all these broken houses and destroyed things because of all the fire and destruction. And people are told that this was a minor attack. So very early on, people are actually quite annoyed because they see, although they understand, you know, that you don't want to be given the Germans information, at the same time, it's like, this is not a minor attack. In fact, when they started releasing the death tolls, the numbers were so low that people were actually very upset about it, including local MPs and government ministers. People were saying, no, you can't do this because if you play down the numbers, people are less likely to believe us in the future. And what happens is there was one report came out initially that said that there was 100 people had died in Clyde Bank. And the response to that from a policeman was, in what street? Which is quite apt because there were streets where there were over 100 people killed, you know, in Clydebank and in Glasgow. So right away, people are getting annoyed at this. And as you move out of these attacks in March, there was also subsequent attacks in April, which didn't really do as much damage. And then another heavy attack in March, which actually attacked further down the Clyde towards Greenock and Greenock and Glasgow. They were the main targets in that attack. So a lot of this is Clydebank is actually in Glasgow is actually just trying to recover and still recovering bodies when the Germans hit again in April, and still recovering bodies when the Germans hit again in May. So there is a total panic in the Clydeside area because they realise that not only can the Germans hit us, but the first attack basically decimated us. And they're concerned about people moving out of Clydebank. And bear in mind, there is a lot of shipyards and industrial workers in Clydebank and Glasgow. The fear is if these people move out, they may never go back to work. You know, and these are important for the work for the war effort. So there's a whole lot of propaganda going on. There's a whole lot of stories going on. As we progress out of that period, you know, in April, and it's one of the controversies about this, is that if you look at how many people died in Clydebank, the official toll was 528 people died in Clydebank. The initial number was 100 and something. And then as it moves along, every time people are arguing and saying, what happened? You know, why there's not, there's a lot more people than this died. The government's upping the figures a little bit. Eventually, we get to this point where, you know, in March, I think it was the Sunday Post or the Sunday Mail, a Scottish newspaper, a year after the event, basically specified that there were over 1,200 people died in Clydebank, not Clydeside, wow. In Clydebank. And that, again, made it, you know, people became very upset by this because they're saying, this is the real figures and you guys are lying to us. Such was the, you know, the uproar and the belief that a lot more people died in these attacks than the government actually said, that when this story ran with this number, people automatically assumed that was the true number because there were so many people had left and so many people they know had died. So what happens is, as you're moving out of this, you've got 528 people died in Clydebank. And this constantly changes. For a few years, there's a lot of inquiries after the war even where people are asking, the council are asking, that's number that you have for Clydebank is not right. We know it's a lot more. And every time they actually investigate the numbers, it changes and it goes up the way. And the 528 is the official final figure that we have for Clydebank. But interestingly, in Glasgow, Glasgow's a bit different. In Glasgow, from the 1st of April, there's 651 deaths that are noted, and it's never been changed. 651 deaths were noted in April 1941, and they have never re-evaluated the figures. So they've kept that figure right from April 1941. Now, there were over 1,500 people seriously injured, not just injured, seriously injured, that were shipped to hospitals all around that area of Stirlingshire, everywhere else. And a lot of my research has found that a lot of these people died 2-3 months. There were some people who even died 2 years later. They were not recorded in the official death toll by enemy action. They died because they never came out of a coma 2 years later in a hospital in Stirling. But the reason they were there was is because they were in Glasgow when it got bombed. But the figures have never been changed. So when you do the sum, I made a statement earlier that I know some people will go, no way, that's true. Because you believe it not to be true because you've never heard it. But when you total the amount of people who were actually killed in Clydeside from these attacks, it's the official total, not might be total, the official total is over 1,200 people, which makes it one of the most deadly attacks, if not the most deadly attack in World War II history, when it came to the Luftwaffe bombing British cities. But what happens is when nobody talks about it, if the IWM doesn't put it on its website of Blitz cities, it doesn't exist. And that's a problem.
This is something you've got to change. You've got to change the statistics. So that would be absolutely, if you could actually pull off the rest of this this research of being able to work out exactly who died when in hospitals and whatnot, that would be an amazing achievement that you've managed to change a statistic that hasn't changed since April 1941.
Yeah. And a large part of what I started off doing with this is because of my grandmother. My grandmother, she only passed away 18 months ago, but she, as I said, she went to that school in Maryhill, and she spoke constantly about the war, constantly to me growing up. So it put a passion, you can probably hear it, I'm impassioned to make sure that this stuff is recorded. You know, and a lot of things that I've did is, you know, I actually have a bomb map of Glasgow with all, and Clydeside, of all the bombings that actually happened, where these bombs dropped. And I'm hoping by the end of my research that I can actually give that to the city of Glasgow or give it to anybody, you know, who will actually make it a focus where people can actually go along and click where they live and see where these people, you know, died in Clydeside, because we have all the names and the details, and where these bombs dropped. And I think that's an important part of changing that narrative, that people can actually see, oh, I live in this street and this street was bombed. I never knew this street was bombed. And that's the thing, a lot of people in Glasgow, because there hasn't been a lot of focus on it, don't know what actually happened in their own city 80 years ago, except if they were told by family members if they lived in that same area. Now, in Clydebank, it's different because it became part of almost the national psyche of Clydebank, being a very small town that was devastated, and it was, there's no denying that, it was devastated in that attack. But it became part of the national psyche that everybody knows about it and everybody commemorates it and memorialises it. In Glasgow, no, never happens, which is very sad.
You've got our backing, Mark. We would love to help you out any way we can, because this is, you know, it is such an important cause, and people should know the history of where they live and where they come from and what their families went through. I mean, somebody could find out something interesting, like their great uncle died in the bombing, or, you know, somebody they know that was injured. It's so fascinating, your research. I absolutely love it.
Well, thank you very much, Alina.
Mark, that was so insightful, and I've learned so much. I knew so little about what was happening in Scotland at the time of the Blitz, and you've taught me so much. And I hope people have enjoyed listening to this podcast, because it is so important to be able to get the narrative right instead of, you know, keeping statistics from April 1941. I mean, my mind is blown. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me on. I thoroughly enjoyed it, Alina.
You can help us at History Hack by joining us via Patreon. It takes quite a lot of effort and a lot of work of quite a big team now to keep us going. And so if you could donate as little as £3 a month, it would be massively appreciated by all of us. There's different levels, because Princess Marcus has set it all up with varying rewards and things. So do have a look, do join us. There's an exclusive Facebook group as well, and you can be part of all of it.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them, and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/hackhistory, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.